Bio Remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Mexico will begin vaccinating healthcare workers on Thursday, a day after Latin America's first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine arrived in Mexico City. Mexico's foreign secretary said the arrival of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine marks the beginning of the end of that pandemic. Mexico is scheduled to receive 1.4 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine. Other Latin American countries are expecting vaccine shipments, or as Argentina did on Wednesday, approving vaccines for use in their country. Pfizer BioNTech says they will supply the United States with an additional 100 million doses of its coronavirus vaccine as the country struggles to contain surges in infections. The drug maker said they expect to complete the delivery by the end of July in a nearly $2 billion deal with the federal government. The U.S. continues to lead the world in COVID-19 deaths with more than 325,000 and more than 18 million coronavirus cases, according to Johns Hopkins University. Europe on Wednesday began easing travel bans on Britain, put in place to contain a new strain of COVID-19 that British officials believe spreads faster. The discovery of the new strain sent off alarm bells worldwide just as more countries, including Switzerland and Qatar, began vaccine campaigns to halt a pandemic that has claimed more than 1.7 million lives since it began a year ago in China. The European Commission has urged EU nations to reopen their borders to Britain and replace the blockades with mandatory tests for arrivals. For details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. Canada's health regulator authorized a second COVID-19 vaccine Wednesday, and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he will extend the suspension of flights from the United Kingdom because of a new variant there, calling the situation very serious. Health Canada said the vaccine from the U.S. biotech firm Moderna is safe for use in the country, and Moderna said it anticipates starting shipments to Canada within 48 hours. It follows the approval of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine earlier this month. U.S. President Donald Trump's latest pardons include his former campaign chairman Paul Manafort, associate Roger Stone, and Charles Kushner, a real estate developer and the father of Trump's son-in-law. In an unusual twist, Trump's advisor, Chris Christie, a former U.S. attorney, prosecuted Kushner. Christie was quoted by CNN as saying Charles Kushner's case was one of the most loathsome, disgusting crimes he prosecuted. Manafort was convicted as part of the special counsel probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Trump had earlier commuted the criminal sentence of Stone, who was convicted of lying under oath to lawmakers. Trump issued the second wave of pardons in as many days after arriving in Palm Beach, Florida, for the holiday season. So far, Trump has pardoned 26 individuals and commuted part or all of the sentences of an additional three people. President Trump also vetoed the annual defense bill, which would have funded the Pentagon with more than $740 billion. Trump has long voiced his displeasure with the bill, calling it very weak, saying he would veto it if it didn't repeal the Communications Decency Act, which shields social media companies from content liability not available to most media companies. Trump also wanted to strip out language that would have renamed some military facilities after Confederate leaders. Late Wednesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the lower chamber would vote on December 28 to override Trump's veto. EU officials say British negotiators are nearing a trade deal as Britain's New Year's Day exit from the 27-nation bloc approaches. Two officials said negotiators are working to resolve a fishing rights issue in British waters in hopes of avoiding a messy economic break between the two sides. Britain is calling for quotas of EU vessels in British waters, and sources from both sides have said that progress is being made in those talks. For additional news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jens Bhatti in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambian police shoot and killed a lawyer for the National Prosecution Authority and a supporter of the main opposition leader.
The people that accompanied Mr. Hichilema were peaceful, and all of a sudden, the Zambian police appeared on the scene, heavily armed, and started shooting using live bullets.
Rights groups in Uganda demand the release of a human rights lawyer. South Africa makes a down payment for COVID-19 vaccine. We'll examine the impact of COVID-19 on school learning this year in Kenya. Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party will take part in next year's legislative elections. And this Sunday is presidential election in Niger.
There are lots of contenders for this election. There are 30 in number, but the major contenders include Mohamed Bazoum, who is from the PNDS Tareya ruling party. Then there is Mahama Usman.
And a Nigerian charity lights up Christmas for vulnerable children during the pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambian police say they have launched an investigation into circumstances that led to the shooting deaths of two people, a lawyer of the National Prosecution Authority and a supporter of Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the opposition United Party for National Development. The U.S. Embassy in Zambia said in a statement that it was deeply saddened and concerned about the deaths. Police say the two were shot at different locations when Mr. Hakainde was summoned to appear for questioning at the police headquarters. Charles Kakoma is spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND.
What happened is that the Zambia police summoned the opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, to appear before them at the Zambia Police Force headquarters. And when Mr. Hichilema went to the police headquarters, there were some people that went with him to offer solidarity as he was going to be questioned by the police. The people that accompanied Mr. Hichilema were peaceful. They did not stone any vehicle. They did not destroy any property. All of a sudden, the Zambia police appeared on the scene, heavily armed, and started shooting using live bullets. And in the process, they shot dead one opposition party member and also a state prosecutor from the Ministry of Justice who was having a meal in a restaurant. It is surprising that the police killed these people in cold blood without any justifiable reason.
The police said that they have not yet received any information about any death resulting from the situation.
Well, the information which the Police Inspector General was giving out to the media this evening, which also appeared on state television, that they are still investigating the circumstances under which the two people were shot dead. So they are aware about the killing of those two people.
The Inspector General of Police says that in the process of dispersing unruly crowd, the two people were reported to have been shot dead in unknown circumstances, which he said the police are investigating.
Yes, of course, the only people with the guns that were at the scene were the policemen themselves. So it is, of course, reasonable to conclude that the police are the ones that shot dead the two people. We do not know what other investigation they will carry out because it is known that they were shot by the police. And the media were there. It was in full view of media people who were capturing on the scene.
So this incident took place, Mr. Kakoma, when Mr. Hichilema had been invited to the police station. Can you tell us exactly why he was invited there?
Well, they were saying they were investigating a case where Mr. Hichilema bought a farm 20 years ago, and they said it was in unclear circumstances, so they wanted to establish how he bought the farm 20 years ago.
So what's next, Mr. Kakoma? What's Mr. Hichilema and your party? What are your plans?
Well, We think that justice must prevail, and we are calling on the government to set up an inquiry.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. Ugandan rights activists are calling on authorities to release human rights lawyer Nicholas Opio, who was arrested for alleged money laundering. Plainclothes security detained Opio on Tuesday with two other colleagues. As Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, supporters say he is being persecuted for his activism.
A group of lawyers and activists went to the Special Investigative Unit of the Ugandan Police Wednesday to demand access to Opio and to ask police to release him. Opio, who is executive director of Chapter 4 Uganda, a human rights organization, was arrested Tuesday with two other colleagues at a restaurant in Kampala. According to Chapter 4, Opio has been collecting evidence surrounding the killings and arrests that occurred during 2 days of protests in Uganda that began on November 18. 56 people were killed in clashes between opposition supporters and security forces following the arrest of singer-turned-politician Bobi Wine, leader of the National Unity Platform Party. Human rights lawyer Elon Kiza says Opio is in good spirits. He does not believe Opio will be released in the usual 48 hours.
They have not formally charged him. They have not recorded his statement yet. We keep monitoring the situation. In the case they agree to release him on bond or decide to charge him.
Police spokesperson Fred Enanga says police and Uganda's Financial Intelligence Authority have been watching Opio and have reasons for his arrest.
It is on record that Nicholas Opio, the lawyer, has been receiving funds from various sources. So you press onward to look at where, first of all, this money is coming from, and then also how it is being channeled locally here, which areas and persons. So those are the lines of inquiry that the Joint Task Team with the Financial Intelligence Unit are handling.
Otsieno Namwaya, the director of Human Rights Watch East Africa, expressed concern about recent arrests in Uganda that he says could undermine the credibility of next month's elections.
The arrest is worrying, especially if police do not immediately charge him with any offense. If the police do not have enough evidence that warrants any charges, then they should release him unconditionally.
Recently, the Financial Intelligence Authority ordered bank accounts frozen for two non-government organizations the FISAs are being used to finance terrorism in Uganda. Both NGOs, the Uganda National NGO Forum and the Uganda Women's Network, were monitoring various parties' election campaigns. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
South Africa has made a $19.2 million payment to Gavi, the co-leader of COVAX Vaccine Alliance, to ensure the country receives its share of the COVID-19 vaccine once it becomes available. The country is now under pressure to secure a vaccine as it is being hit by the second wave of a new variation of the coronavirus. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The second wave of COVID-19 infections, sparked largely by a new variant of the known virus, has pushed authorities to allow no delay in securing a vaccine. Although the vaccines purchased under COVAX will not be delivered until next year, Department of Health Director General Sandile Buthelezi says the payment is a crucial step.
We are very happy that we have finally managed to pay in the deposit into the COVAX facility. We have also been allocated budget by Treasury, which will then take care of the actual procurement when we move forward.
However, this is only the first in many steps, as the payment is only 15% of the total required to buy vaccines for 10% of South Africa's population. The second wave already is overstretching resources in provinces such as Eastern Cape, Western Cape, Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal. Professor Thuli de Oliveira is the director of the KZN Research Innovation and Sequencing Platform.
It started close to where our second wave of the infection started, in the Eastern Cape, close to the Nelson Mandela Bay, where it starts spreading at very fast pace, is in the Nelson Mandela Bay, So that is concerning, how one lineage dominating this pandemic in the second wave.
In November, the first wave of coronavirus infections in South Africa had subsided to below 2,000 new infections a day from 13,000. The second wave has brought those numbers to more than 9,000 a day, while fatalities are also up by more than 50%. This has left health workers and citizens fearing for their lives. Even young South African citizens like Lita Vuge are concerned.
Everything is worrying me about the second wave. We're going to go into 2021 with even maybe more challenges than we had in 2020. So yeah, it kills hope and it's really bad. It's terrifying. We don't know what it will bring. Will it be worse? Will it get better?
Over 9,000 people have tested positive with COVID-19 since the first case in March this year. Above 25,000 people have succumbed to the pandemic in South Africa. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 24. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought many changes across the globe. In the education sector, the physical classroom has begun to lose its value as the place of teaching and learning, as many countries embrace online learning as a way of fighting the spread of the COVID-19. At the same time, and as Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, online schooling in Kenya revealed the inequality in learning, as some students could not access learning due to poor network and lack of materials.
Online learning in Kenya and sub-Saharan Africa faces many challenges brought about by insufficient infrastructure facilities such as network and internet-enabled electronics. Andai Shihanda is a high school teacher in Samburu County, a marginalized rural area in Kenya. He says the school could not access all the students through Zoom meeting, and even after identifying an easier mode of learning online, the parents claimed they could not afford the cost of internet and smartphone since most of them lost their jobs due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Zoom meetings could only reach 20 candidates who are living near trading centers. Hoping that others would join later, we agreed to start with the revision sessions. Out of these, many could log in and out so many times during a single session due to fluctuating network. Some teachers too weren't online all the time. Covering of new content was discouraged because it would be a disadvantage to those candidates who had not yet been reached.
As parents assumed teachers' duties to guide the students at home, most of the parents say the learning was a challenge, especially for the working ones. Corinne Batty is a mother of three primary school girls. She says the online learning meant that parents could dig more into their pockets to buy the smartphones and guide the students at home, a move, she says, makes her struggle to balance between guiding the children and working.
As a parent, I was a bit challenged because of a gadget. I needed to have extra gadgets. So what I did at times, I had to go to work and leave my laptop at home, wait for my teachers to update on the Zoom platform, what class we're going to have, what the link is, so I'd have to call back home. There was a time where I had a challenge because I didn't have extra gadgets, and learning was a bit of a challenge, and I was always under pressure. Sometimes I had to pull over the road, send back home the links.
In Kenya, most universities hold graduation ceremonies in August and December, and this year's celebration were held virtually, and graduates watched TV waiting for their names to be called out. Anthony Muraya graduated last week from Chuka University, and he said that he did not enjoy the online ceremony.
We did a graduation online, and it was not the best. I did not like it. It was quite different from the physical graduation, since, you know, the physical one would interact, have fun with other graduates. Some of us were streamlining the event. And Kenya being a developing country, there's a challenge in network. Other people didn't even hear their name.
The education experts say the African countries should embrace online learning to avoid the challenges that the learning institutions are facing during this period of the COVID-19 pandemic. An education expert, Otoa Sifuna, said that the government of Kenya should ensure there is equity in all schools, given that some learners could not afford online learning for lack of equipment.
This online teaching has been happening very selectively. We should leverage very, very strongly on digital platform.
Kenya's Ministry of Education ordered that when schools reopen in January 2021, students should resume learning from where they left from when schools closed in March this year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
The people of Niger are voting this Sunday in presidential election. Incumbent President Mahamadou Issoufou is stepping down after completing 2 5-year terms. On the line in Niamey is VOA's Hausa Service reporter Makmo Lalo.
First of all, James, Niamey, the Nigeria's capital, is wearing a very colorful and beautiful look. You will see a lot of banners colorfully adorning the entire city with big billboards of presidential candidates where they pasted their posters, you know, advertising themselves to the voters. Election campaign is going smoothly, no any hitches. So far, so good. Everything is going on the right track. The voters are just waiting for Sunday, the 27th of December, to rush to the polls to elect a new leader for the next 5 years.
Who are the contenders for the presidential race?
Well, there are lots of contenders for this election. There are 30 in number, but the major contenders include Mohamed Bazoum, who is from the PNDS Tareya ruling party. Then there is Mahamat Usman, who is also another contender in this election. This morning, Mahamat Amadou announced an alliance with Mahamat Usman, meaning Mahamat Amadou called on his supporters to vote for Mahamat Usman, who is from the RDR party. This is the alliance that is going to take place where the two major contenders include Mahamat Bazoum from the PNDS and now Mahamat Usman from the RDR party, who has the full backing of Mahamat Amadou, who was disqualified from this race.
President Issoufou is stepping down after his 2 5-year term. Talk to us about this development, particularly in the context of West African politics.
Yeah, this is really interesting because it's a departure from what we used to see, especially in African context of politics, where you see leaders trying to secure for themselves a third term, like what we have in the case of Guinea and Alassane Ouattara of Cote d'Ivoire. Issoufou Mahamadou is stepping down after finishing his 2 terms of 5 5 years, which is completely a different scenario from what we used to see happen in the political arena in Africa.
So what are some of the possible challenges for the next president of Niger? Economically, politically, what are some of the challenges?
Niger is known to be one of the countries that has the poorest population in Africa. This is one of the issues that the next leader is going to tackle. And there's issue of insurgency, especially in areas of Tillaberi and Diffa, which has a border with Nigeria. Then there is also other areas that has border with Mali, Burkina Faso, Libya, all areas and borders. Insurgents or sometimes government used to come into Niger, launch an attack, and rush back to where they come from. Then there's also the issue of coronavirus. Even though they don't have a high number of cases, this is something that is always at the back of Nigerians who want to see this issue of coronavirus, considering the fact that it's really causing a lot of destruction, issues like closing of schools, closing of major government buildings, and the rest of it.
Mamu, thank you very much again, and we look forward to speaking with you again, probably on Election Day Sunday. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jim. Thank you so much.
That was VOA's Hausa Service reporter Makmo Lalo speaking with us from the Nigerian capital, Niamey. In Ivory Coast, after boycotting elections for the last 10 years, former President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front Party says it will take part in the 2021 legislative elections. The party and its partners in the opposition coalition this week entered into a national dialogue with President Alassane Ouattara's ruling party. The president said he hopes the dialogue will help bring about peaceful legislative elections. Jean-Yves Tchéide is the vice president for finance of former President Gbagbo's party.
Well, the party had already decided to go to all oncoming elections since 2018 at the Congress. The last Congress was held in 2018. So according to that decision made at the Congress, the day before yesterday, we decided to go to the coming elections because we had already tried to run for the presidential election, but our candidacy was banned by the Electoral Commission and the Constitutional Court. Nevertheless, we decided to go on to the oncoming elections because we want to have a representative at the parliament, and also we want to have senators.
Your party and the other opposition parties, you have been involved in some dialogue with the Ouattara government. First of all, what is the purpose of this dialogue that is going on?
The purpose of the dialogue is one, to discuss and come to a certain agreement about the Electoral Commission. We have always been saying that the Electoral Commission is not in a good shape because the composition is under the control of the government. So we want to split and have 50-50 in terms of representatives of each party. Now, we have started the discussion, and today we went deeper in the different topics. We started with the topic concerning the political environment of the election, which means that we are asking the government to release the political prisoners who are still in detention. This is the first topic of discussion, and we shall continue tomorrow. We have not come to any agreement yet.
Now, President Ouattara has appointed a new minister specifically for what he called national reconciliation, to bring about cohesion. With the decision to participate in this election next year, does this mean now that the opposition will drop all the issues that it has been talking about?
No, we have not dropped all our demands. But when you are in politics, at some time you should decide how to go on. You cannot stick to one point if you know that there is no way through. So you must find another way, even if that way it should be longer than the one you had decided before. So we have decided to change our tactics. So that's what we are doing.
Jean-Yves Tchaïde is the vice president for finance of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abidjan. Millions of Nigerian Christians are facing a bleak Christmas due to the economic impact from COVID-19 lockdowns that have increased unemployment and food prices. Some Nigerian charities are providing food to vulnerable groups as the government reopens border trade closed for over a year to stop smuggling to offer some relief. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Internally displaced people lined up at an Abuja camp and sang cheerfully as they received rice, beans and spices from a charity TAP initiative ahead of Christmas. The coronavirus pandemic shrank Nigeria's economy this year by more than 3.5%, driving up job losses and food prices. TAP Initiative's Mimiwa Ahile says her group is trying to help some of the countries most affected.
Millions of people in Nigeria do not know where their next meal is coming from. And people want to celebrate Christmas. People want to eat. People want to be happy. They want to live their lives.
Philibia Elisha, who fled Borno State a decade ago because of Boko Haram militants, was among the beneficiaries. Elisha says she and her husband lost their means of survival due to the coronavirus disruptions and that this year has been the most challenging. When COVID-19 came, we suffered. My husband became jobless and I am jobless, so we suffered a lot. Last week, December 16th, Nigerian authorities reopened border trade with Benin, Cameroon, and Niger to help boost the COVID-hit economy. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Nigeria halted border trade in August of last year to stop smuggling and support local producers, authorities said. But lack of local manufacturing capacities put pressure on food prices, which jumped about 17%. Trade experts like Ken Ife say Nigeria is a key member of Africa trade, and the reopened borders should help member states of the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, to recover, including Nigeria. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that's it for this Thursday, December 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.